who's standing right in front of him. He's changed the topic and is discussing how we can become free from all this material entanglement by taking shelter of the Supreme Lord's lotus feet. And now he's going to describe how and why this Supreme Lord creates the material world. Actually, it's only in the Vaishnav culture that we understand, Vaishnav religion, that we understand properly why this material world was created by God. So many people in the world have a theistic idea that there is a God, the supreme controller and creator. And unless you just are totally unrealistic and deny the reality that's right in front of our nose, everyone has to admit that this world exists. Only people like the Mayavadis try to argue that it doesn't really exist, but it's hard to deny the existence of the reality that we're constantly living in. So what's the relationship between the two? Okay, God is the creator of this world. Why did he create it? It's a place of suffering. It's a place of limitations. God is all perfectly created. It's a place of suffering. It's a place of limitations. God is all perfect, and he should be all compassionate. It doesn't make sense that God is just whimsical or diabolical, but he wants us to suffer and suffer all these limitations. So why? Here's God, we assume he exists. Here's the world, we can't deny it exists. Why did God create this world? So that is understood in the Vaishnava revelation. Srimad Bhagavatam and other books that present the science of pure devotional service, they're the only sources where we can actually find an answer to this question. And Kardama Muni is shifting now to this discussion. So Kardama, he's actually quite an advanced devotee. He's got some material desire, therefore he came to this world. But because he's a very devoted servant of the Lord, despite his personal ambition to be a Prajapati, to be a creator of progeny, therefore he's being given a very responsible service. He's going to first of all give birth to 9 daughters who are going to marry the other Prajapatis, and they're going to become mothers of many of the demigods and sages. And then his last child, Lord Kapila, will be the incarnation of Godhead, who will teach science of Godhead. But he presents himself, in the first part of his prayers, he's presenting himself as a karmi. I'm just one of these foolish materialists who approach God for something very insignificant. So he's, first of all, showing himself in the worst light. But now that he's shifted the topic and he's brought God into the picture and actually admitted that the solution to all this embarrassing predicament is to surrender to God, now he shifts and begins presenting himself as a Gyani, or again a Nishvabhakta. So we may be confused, what is Kardama really? What is his actual position? That, who can tell? But he's talking as if he was something of a Gyani, that he's interested in understanding philosophically, scientifically, the nature of the self, and how to become liberated. These are the concerns of the Gyani. They want to know, what is the spiritual nature? They're not even always concerned with distinguishing between, you know, they want to know what's the atma, the real essential self, the living being. The jnanis don't very much care to even distinguish between the jivatma and the paramatma. Sometimes they distinguish, sometimes they don't. Because their prime motivation is liberation. They're not pure devotees. They have this actually material motivation of getting themselves out of the cycle of birth and death. So if you can understand the jivatma, if you understand your spiritual nature, you're liberated. And that's all they want. So they don't even care to distinguish the personality of Godhead from the jiva. Anyway, this is more or less the attitude that Hardiman is emulating now in his last part of his prayers. Gyana Mishra Bhakti attitude. You find it in many of the Upanishads. The Upanishads are really not completely impersonal. Many of the Upanishads discuss the glories of the Supreme Person. But always in the back, that background is this motive of liberation. We want to understand God. We even want to understand our relationship with God and our duty to serve God, but for the purpose of becoming liberated. So anyway, verse 19 we'll look at right now. Text 19. Ekat svayam saṁ jagatat sushritsvaya advitiya yātmam ariyoga māyaya svijasya tat pāsi punar kvasishyase yattur na nādhir bhagavan svashakti bihi. Translation. My dear Lord, you alone create the universes, O Personality of Godhead. Desiring to create these universes, you create them, maintain them, and again wind them up by your own energies, which are under the control of your second energy called Yogamaya. Just as a spider creates a cobweb by its own energy and again winds it up. So, ekaha. Prabhupada says in the purport, there are two words in this verse that particularly nullify the impersonal conception. Ekaha and Yoga Mayaya. First of all, Ekaha. The Supreme Person, he alone is the creator, the maintainer, and the destroyer. He's supreme, absolute, complete person. He has within himself all the potencies to create everything, to maintain it and to destroy it. But it's not that he depletes himself, that by expanding himself he becomes something less. In other theistic conceptions, they have difficulty understanding how God can expand himself, how he can become, he's one, how he can become many without becoming imperfect. God is perfect. So like the Mayavadis, you know, the Supreme is perfect, undivided, formless. How can he be a person and still be perfect? So even in the Western world, the early Christians, following the Greek philosophy of the Neoplatonists, they tried to understand, you know, make a theology, an explanation of who is God. And they pretty much came up with a Mayavadi explanation. God is originally undivided. He doesn't do anything. He doesn't have a personality. Or he doesn't reveal his personality. Certainly doesn't do anything. So, how is the work of creation done if God doesn't do anything? So they come up with a conception of something called a demiurge, a second person, sort of a shadow of God. This demiurge, this semi-God, does the actual creation. That creator person, whoever he is, he's not perfect, because if you're doing something, you're not perfect. God is just sitting in his rocking chair, you know, not doing anything. Anyway, they just can't grasp the idea how the Supreme can act, especially how he can expand out of himself all the dualities and all the imperfection of material creation without making himself imperfect. So that has to be, it's explained in the Upanishads. But still, even after looking at the Upanishads, no one can understand it properly without the Vaishnav insight. With the blessings of a pure devotee, you can understand this mystery. Otherwise, you can study all the Vedas, all the Upanishads, the Vedanta Sutra, backwards and forwards, for lifetimes, and you won't understand. It will still remain confusing. But here, in Bhagavatam, it's being presented, if we study the Bhagavatam with the guidance of the pure devotees, we'll understand. Here's two words, ekaha. Okay, all by himself, he does this creation. All by himself, but there is this yogamaya. So, you know, we have a demiurge in our philosophy. You know, you can consider Lord Brahma the secondary creator. But he's just a jiva. He's just an engineer. The engineer is just somebody you hire. We're going to build this huge temple on the order of Srila Prabhupada. Do the wonder of the world. But, you know, we'll hire some company to come and be the construction agent, you know, the engineer. It's just somebody you hire. So Brahma is just the engineer of the universe. But the real agent, the real first-hand assistant of the Supreme is Yogamaya, is creative potency, is creative energies. The one Supreme Person can expand himself unlimitedly, even into imperfection, even make his energies limited and imperfect, without diminishing himself, without becoming anything less than what he is, by having his energies do the work for him. Especially, first of all, his creative energy, Yogamaya. Of course, the material energy is simply just a shadow or an expansion of his internal pleasure potency. So actually the original creative energy is Krishna's own internal his consort. But for the work of creating the material world, she expands into material nature. So that one person, through the agency of his personal energy, he creates everything without becoming anything, contaminated himself. Prabhupada points out that the other thing that we should see from this description is that the Lord is conscious. Prabhupada uses the word sentient. He's conscious. And he's all powerful. So therefore, he's capable, Prabhupada says, of hearing his devotees' prayers. Kartam is convinced of that because the Lord has come personally. There's no doubt about it for Kartam that Krishna can hear his devotee's prayers, and he does choose to answer. The Lord's transcendental existence is Satchidananda. He has a body, and that body is purely spiritual. Okay, we'll read the next verse. We begin discussing, getting the answer, why. Why does the Lord create the material world? Text 20. Naita nirbhatadisha param tavepsitam yan maya yanas tanushe puta sukshmam
anugrahayat api yadhi mayaya vavasat tulasya bhagavan vilapshitaha.
My dear Lord, although it is not your desire, you manifest this creation of gross and subtle elements just for our sensual satisfaction. Let your causeless mercy be upon us, for you have appeared before us in your eternal form, adorned with a splendid wreath of tulsi leaves. So the Lord remains in his personal glory. He doesn't become impersonal by expanding into the inert material creation. He's there, worshipped by Tulsi, embraced by his internal potency. And he doesn't create the world because he wants to, although that's sometimes said like that. You know, Sa'aishata Loka Nusrija in the Aitareya Upanishad. The Lord glanced and he thought, let me create progeny, let me create worlds. So it sounds like God wanted to create something. He was bored or he was lonely and he wanted to make something to play with. But here it's explained, that's only a superficial perception. He's expressing a desire, but it's not really his own desire. God wants to create the world only because we want the world, and he wants to give us what we want. He's a benevolent father, fulfilling the whims of the children. That's explained here. O Lord, Kardama addresses Lord Narayan, you don't want this creation, but you created for us because we want sense gratification. We want to enjoy, not by gratifying your senses, we want to try letting ourselves be the object of gratification instead. We want to be the enjoyers and controllers. So you kindly give us a separate world in which we can try to do that, to fulfill our desires. The Lord has no business with material creation. He's just doing it because the rebellious souls are insisting on it. And Prabhupada discusses in the purport that similarly, the Lord's pure devotees also have no business with the material creation. It's a terrible, fearful place. Padam, padam, yad vipadam natesham. It's a place where there's danger and embarrassment at every step. Therefore, it's not a proper place. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati gave the example of a toilet. It's not a fit place for a gentleman to loiter. You go in there, do your business, and get out. Here's Kardama. You've got some business. I've got to go to the toilet. So I have some business I have to do. I don't sit in the toilet for hours admiring the architecture. I do my business and get out. Kardama is in this world, but he intends to do his business and get out as quickly as possible. Here's a question. What excuse do devotees have for remaining in this world? What can we do here that justifies our remaining here? Okay, I can think of one other thing. Preaching is the most useful thing to do. One other thing that I can think of. I'll help the Lord kill demons. There's only two things that the Supreme Lord and his agents can do here that they can't do in the spiritual world. There's no scope for preaching. They can encourage each other in devotional service, but there's no conditioned souls to preach to in the spiritual world. So if you want to really preach, you have to come here. The other is, you want to kill demons. There's no actual demons in the spiritual world. In Goloka, everybody's worried that Keshi is going to come and attack, but he never comes. Sometimes it's described they're just like cardboard figures of the demons up there, but the real demons never come. So when the Lord wants to fight
with enemies. When the devotees want to help him destroy his enemies, they have to come to the material world. So those two things are the only excuse, justification a devotee has for remaining in the world. Either you're going to help the Lord kill demons, or you're going to help him preach. Otherwise, get out. Hasn't taken birth in the past times of Lord Ramachandra, where he can join the monkey army, or at the time of Kalki avatar. No. He's in Satyuga, there aren't many demons to kill. And he has not been empowered to do so much preaching himself. He's going to give birth to a preacher. And then he goes to take sannyas and go back to Godhead. That's his business. So that's his devotional service. It's Krishna's decision ultimately. It's Krishna's choice for a devotee, what the devotee is supposed to do. If he wants you to preach, then he puts you in a position for preaching. If he wants you to do something else as his service, then he arranges that. Devotees let Krishna make the arrangements. Although Kardama, he's preaching here in his prayers. A few verses only, but that's his preaching career. And he's preaching to Lord Vishnu, but at least we hear it. So Prabhupada also discusses in the purport how the Lord mercifully shows, it says in the verse, the Lord mercifully shows his personal form in this world. Or, Prabhupada says in the purport, he sends a reliable son or servant or a reliable author like Vyasadeva to give instructions. So most of, Krishna describes why he takes birth in the fourth chapter of the Gita, Parichanaya Sarunam, Vina Shaya Chaduskritam, Dharma Samstarpanartaya, Sambhavani Yuge Yuge. Krishna comes periodically to this world. He comes down in his incarnate avatars to deliver the devotees, to destroy the demons, and to reestablish principles of religion. Three purposes. But actually, can't all those three purposes be done indirectly by somebody else? Krishna can arrange for the material energy to kill demons. Just, some flood or famine or war, and dispose of millions of demons at a time. Unwanted population can be removed by Krishna, just without lifting a finger. Why does he have to come here for that? Of course, he likes to play. He likes to come and have the sport of fighting with big demons. But he doesn't have to do it himself. So, in the same way, to save the devotees from demoniac interference danger, he can also arrange for some saintly devotee to become a great king and dispose of all the unruly elements. Krishna doesn't have to do it himself. He can deputize, empower anybody else to do it, even to establish principles of religion. Krishna can empower their empowered incarnations like Vyasadeva, who can enlighten the whole human society and reestablish the Vedic principles. Krishna doesn't have to come himself to do it. But he mercifully, the real essential purpose is hinted at, Parichranaya Sadhuram, to deliver his devotees. But the devotees don't have any material problems. They're not afraid of, real devotees are not afraid of some demon coming in and destroying them. Real devotees don't have any enemies or anything to be afraid of. They trust that Krishna will protect them, but they cannot tolerate separation from him. That they can't see him is the greatest calamity. So he delivers them then from that calamity by showing himself. That's how, actually, it's explained by Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur, that's what it means. The Lord delivers his devotees, Parichranaya Sadhanam. He delivers them from the anxiety of not being able to see him by showing himself. So that's the prime purpose why the Lord appears in this world, makes his incarnations. Another reason connected to that is that, okay, Vyasadeva and other sages can present the Vedic literature. But what does Vyasadeva describe in the Bhagavatam? Krishna's incarnations. What would he have to talk about if Krishna never had any incarnations? If the Supreme Lord doesn't personally come himself, he can do everything else indirectly. But if he doesn't come himself, no one will have a definite idea what God is, of how God is a person. All the philosophers and all the sages will be left to speculate and guess what God is. So to remove all this guesswork, God has to come himself and say, here I am, this is what I am. These are my leelas, this is my personality. So in order to remove all the doubt among the philosophers about what is God, God has to show himself. So that's how he establishes the principles of religion, actually. By revealing himself so that great sages like Vyasadeva can record what they saw and what they heard about when the Lord personally appeared. So the Lord himself is involved in this propaganda work. Prabhupada talks about propaganda work to convince the misguided living entities to come back and surrender. So the Lord himself initiates this propaganda work to reclaim the wayward souls. And then he empowers and inspires his servants to carry on this work, this preaching work. Krishna advises in the end of the Bhagavad Gita, Sarva Dharmam Parityaja Mami Kam Sharanam Vraja. Just give up all your business in this world. Put everything aside, what you think your responsibilities and duties are, and just surrender to me, become my servant, full-time servant, and trust fully in me. And I'll deliver you. So Kardama has a good idea of this. He has a good conception. He understands why. He's not a fool. Kardama understands, and very few people do understand properly, why God created this world, why he comes to this world personally, what the business of God is. We're servants of God, so we should understand what is the business of our master, because we're supposed to be helping him in his business. So Kardama understands. This makes him, that marks him as a good servant. He's a very good devotee. Yes, sir.
Yes, that is why
yes. Yes. He's even more eligible. He's, you know, this makes him eligible to become Father of God. Yeah. That he has that not just sentiment, but he has tattvagyan, scientific understanding. Janma karma chame divyam. This is the point you're just making. Janma karma chame divyam. One who understands, Krishna says, how I'm born and how I act, and my birth and activities are special. One who understands that doesn't have to take birth again. He comes back to me. He's liberated. But he doesn't say just liberated, merged into the Supreme, but he says comes back to me. Mamiti. So understanding God's birth and activities is qualification not just for liberation, but for re-entrance into pure devotional service. Okay, we can look at text 21. There's and then there's three more verses of his prayers.
Tam tvānu bhūtyo paratā kriyārtham svamāyaya vartita lokatantram namāmya bhikṣṇam namaniya pāra sarojam alpiyasi kāma varsham.
I continuously offer my respectful obeisances unto your lotus feet, of which it is worthy to take shelter, because you shower all benedictions on the insignificant.
to give all living entities detachment from fruitive activity by realizing you. You have expanded these material worlds by your own energy. So, the Supreme Person creates this world. You can say he creates it to give us facility to try to enjoy separately. But his higher purpose is to teach us detachment and give us the opportunity to detach ourselves from the entanglement by realizing him. Now, okay, go in the world, try to enjoy, make a fool of yourself, but I intend that you come back to me, and I will give you facility for that. That's his ultimate purpose. So Kardama is very grateful. He's offering he's bowing down and offering his thanks, especially since he considers himself one of these very insignificant, foolish persons who have rebelled against him, the Supreme Person. So he's so grateful. You are showering. So it's like the rain pours down, you know, both on the fertile field and on the dry rocks also. The Lord's mercy pours down on those who deserve it and also those who don't. So he's very thankful. Even though I, Kardama, don't deserve your mercy, still you're showering me with it. I'm such an insignificant person. I've disqualified myself by rebelling against you, and still you're doing everything to bring me back. Prabhupada makes the very important point in the purport. This shows that everybody should offer obeisances to the Supreme Lord. Whether he's free from desires or full of desires, still he should approach the Supreme Lord for the fulfillment of his desires. Certainly, the all-powerful personality of Godhead is capable of fulfilling everybody's desires, and he's willing to do that. Akamak sarakamo va mokshakama udarati. If someone is smart, whether he's got all sorts of material desires, or whether he wants liberation, or whether he doesn't want anything in particular, just wants to surrender, he should approach the Supreme Lord and try to serve him enthusiastically, with intense devotional service. Whatever his motive is, that he'll get what he wants best and most quickly by trying to serve the Supreme Person. Anyway, for those who can't understand that, the Vedas provide alternative methods for approaching perfection. Karmakanda and Gyanakanda processes. For most people who are really foolish, I think that this world is for their, it's really the place that they're supposed to remain and to try to enjoy and succeed. The Karmakanda rituals of the Vedas give them opportunities to try to achieve material success, whatever their idea of success is, whether they're so foolish they just want a lot of money, or whether they just want, you know, a good wife or good reputation, where they want to go to a higher planet. Whatever they want, the Vedas, through their rituals, offer the opportunity to achieve those ambitions. And at the same time, make an offering to the Supreme Lord. That's Karmakanda. The Gyanakanda is there who've seen the illusion of this, and now they want liberation. They want out of this trap. So the Gyanakanda is there, especially in the Upanishads. How to understand the absolute truth and merge back into that absolute truth. Prabhupada makes the point, liberation is for one who is disgusted with material enjoyment. Atato Brahma Jigyasa, first declaration of the Vedanta Sutra. Now, let's inquire into the absolute truth. Now that we've tried to enjoy this world, The commentators, Baladeva Dibhushan, and the earlier commentators like, I think even Shankaracharya, and then Ramanujacharya, quote the same verse also from one of the Upanishads. Pariksha lokan, kara chitan, nivedam ayat, nasya pritak pritena. After seeing, wandering around these worlds and seeing how everything you can achieve by karmic endeavors is just temporary and limited, one should give up his interest, become disinterested in all this material endeavor. Nasti akritak pritena. You can't achieve the eternal world that is not created by material work. It is just something materially created. What is created can't help you achieve what is not created. In other words, material work won't help you achieve the eternal kingdom of God. And then, anybody know the second half of the verse? I'm sure everybody knows the second half of the verse. Yeah. Tadvigyanartham sagurum eva bigachet simitpani shrotriyam brahmanishtam. That's the second half of that shloka from the Mundak Upanishad, I think. In order to understand how everything in this world is just temporary, you can't achieve perfection by these imperfect means, by this karma kanda or jnana kanda. Therefore, to understand the higher truth, one has to approach a transcendental spiritual master who is Shrotriyam and Brahmanishtam, who is learned in the scriptures and the Vedas, and is dedicated, has dedicated his life to the service of the Absolute. And his disciple must approach humbly. So therefore the metaphor is given, he has to hold firewood in his hands. So we don't, you know, in the modern Vaishnav culture, we don't make that prescription that you want to take initiation, you have to bring a pile of firewood. Because our modern day acharyas are not busy performing fire sacrifices. That's from previous ages. It used to be the Brahmins and the Rishis, they sat in their ashrams, meditated, and performed fire sacrifices every day. So if someone wanted to come and become a disciple, he showed that he was ready to do menial service by arriving in the ashram with a bundle of firewood under his arm. It's a sign of showing, a way of showing that you're, even if you're a king's son or a big Brahmin's son, you're willing to become a menial disciple, a humble disciple. That way, that's the explanation. That verse is used by almost all the Vedanta Sutra commentaries to explain this first sutra. Now, we should inquire what's the absolute truth. Now that we've seen that everything you can achieve in this world is petty, and that one has to go to a spiritual master and get transcendental knowledge. If we realize that much, now it's time to start inquiring into what is the absolute truth. And the Upanishads will teach us. Yeah, what's the absolute truth? If what you want is liberation, that's where you should go. We also consider liberation important. Brahma-bhuta prasanatmana shoshati na kakshati samap sarveshu bhuteshu madbhaktim labhate param. Krishna says if you want to enter into pure devotional service, you have to become liberated first. The person who's free from desire for material success, he's satisfied. Because he doesn't have any material ambitions. He's not agitated by material ambitions, so he's satisfied with whatever he has. He's not aspiring for some material success. And therefore, he's not lamenting. He's not hankering for things.
And he's equal. He doesn't have any friends and enemies. So that person can begin pure devotional service. So that liberation, and that's required as a preliminary prerequisite for devotional service. So Kardama is not just speaking as an impersonalist, all this talk about liberation. It's also, we also have to first of all become, give up this material life, become liberated, and then we can seriously prosecute devotional service. Anyway, there's those who aren't that intelligent and they want to lord it over material nature. Prabhupada says in the purport, for those who want to lord it over material nature, material knowledge and science are available. And if somebody wants, he makes another statement, if somebody wants, he loves Krishna, but he wants material enjoyment, then he's in perplexity. That's an embarrassing situation. You actually have love of God, or at least you have a strong sentiment that you want to love God, but you've got material, you want to enjoy also the material world. That puts you in an embarrassing situation. That's how Kardama feels about himself. Anyway, Prabhupada explains, even for us who are embarrassed by our contradictory natures, Krishna gives us the opportunity to engage in practicing devotional service. This is the great benefit of sadhana bhakti. You don't have to be a paramahamsa to start it. You don't have to be free completely from material desires. You just have to have a strong desire to give your life to Krishna. And then all those obstacles of desire for material success, enjoyment, and for liberation, they'll gradually be purified away. They'll dissipate. And then, Prabhupada says, gradually we forget the hallucination. So this is what Kardama is discussing here. And that's the end of Kardama's prayers. Now, beginning with verse 22 is just one statement by Maitreya Muni, who's narrating this story to Vidur. Okay, I didn't make any comments on it. So 22, I'll just read the verse. Vishiru Vacha Ityavalikam Panutob Janavas Tamabhavashe Vachasamitena Suparna Paksho Parirochamana Premas Mitod Vikshana Vibramat Bruhu. Okay. Translation. Maitreya resumed. Sincerely extolled in these words, Lord Vishnu, shining very beautifully on the shoulders of Garuda, replied with words as sweet as nectar. His eyebrows moved gracefully as he looked at the sage with a smile full of affection. So this is not just some mechanical interchange. You know, you pay your money and you get what you pay for. This is a very personal encounter. And we'll hear in a minute what Vishnu has to say to Kardama. So any comments here? Any questions? No? Okay. Yes, ma'am. Yes. Okay. If you didn't hear, you know, that verse talked about carrying firewood. So that's how in ancient times a disciple should show that he's ready to do humble service. Well, see what nowadays is the sign. Prabhupada made it clear that, you know, what he wants everybody to do is chant Hare Krishna and participate. If you want to join this ISKCON movement, ISKCON is about preaching. So
show some interest in participating in the preaching activities of this movement. So if you want that, that's the equivalent, our equivalent of carrying firewood. You should pick up a bead bag and be ready to do some active service for the spreading of Krishna consciousness. That's how we demonstrate the Prabhupada and to whomever we want to accept as Prabhupada's representative, that we're serious, that we want to be servants. You show that you want to be a servant by being ready to do some service. So in the ancient times, that meant, you know, come with the firewood and get ready to sit down and we'll do some sacrifices. So same idea, you know, get your bead bag and get ready to do some service. Then we demonstrate it like that. Okay. All right. Let's look at Lord Vishnu's response to Kardama, starting with verse 23. He's talking in short verses, Anushrut, eight syllable lines. Anyway, the points made in Lord Vishnu's answer to Kardama, just a few verses. He explains to Kardama that he always looks after his devotees. He always fulfills their desires. And especially, he favors the Brahmins. And the Brahmins are always worshipable. These are the points that Vishnu is going to make. So verse 23. Sri Bhagavan Uvacha Viditva Tava Chaityam Ne Puraiva Samayojitat Yadartam Atma Niyamais Tvayaiv Aham Samarchitaha. The Supreme Lord said, having come to know what was in your mind, I have already arranged for that for which you have worshipped me well through your mental and sensory discipline. So, Vishnu, Supreme Person, he knew already long time ago, before Kardama opened his mouth, before he even started his meditation 10,000 years before. He knew beforehand. And he's already made all the arrangements to fulfill Kardama's desires. No problem for Vishnu, for Krishna, to make all arrangements. We feel frustrated that we have our ambitions and Krishna's not fulfilling them. It's not that he can't, it's not that he's ignorant of what we want or incapable of making the proper arrangements. Whatever obstacles we see, that's just the illusion of Maya. You know, material energy is set up to make us think that there's so many impossible obstacles. Krishna can, without even lifting a finger, remove all of those obstacles and facilitate our immediately facilitate the fulfillment of all our desires. He doesn't do that because he wants us first to surrender. No sense in just gratifying us until we give up our material attachments and misconceptions. When we develop a pure devotional attitude, then Krishna will fulfill all desires. But if he gives us what we want, and we're still wanting the wrong thing, and wanting it the wrong way, then that won't do any good. So Krishna withholds. He's not like Lord Shiva. He doesn't just give his supplicants whatever they want just to get rid of them. He's called Ashutosh. So someone like Vikasura, you know, starts chopping off his own flesh, throwing it in the fire, and Shiva just comes and says, "What do you want? You know? Can you stop this? What do you want? I'll give it to you, whatever it is." So that's Ashutosh. Vishnu is not Ashutosh. You know, he's more compassionate for his devotees. He doesn't give them necessarily what they want if they're too immature to ask for the right thing. But in Kardama's case, no problem. Don't worry, Kardama. I know what you wanted even before you even started asking for it, and I've already arranged for everything to be supplied. This is the Lord's intimate connection with his devotees. Even the devotees who are not completely perfect in their spiritual advancement,
Kartama is still a sadhaka. He's still working toward perfection. But Vishnu is satisfied enough. He's ready to give him everything. Prabhupada explains in the purport, Krishna never disappoints his sincere devotees. But he doesn't give them what will be detrimental to their own service. He deals with each of his devotees individually, and he's careful not to give them anything he needs and what's appropriate. So therefore,
just be satisfied with the quota that's given to you by God. Enjoy that. Don't be greedy for what someone else gets. We've been given our own share accordingly to what we need and what's good for us. This is a basic principle of the Vedic social system, Varnashram Dharma. That we each have different positions, and we each have certain privileges and facilities and responsibilities. We should accept our own position and not try to change to someone else's position. And not be worried about, oh, he's got this and I don't. You know, he's a big king and I'm a poor man. The poor man should be satisfied, the king should be satisfied, the Brahmin should be satisfied. One should be satisfied with his prescribed position in the Vedic system, in the Varnashram system. This is what people in the modern world can't tolerate. This idea of passivity, you know, to accept your position, a position in the Vedic system, in the Varnashram system. This is what people in the modern world can't tolerate. This idea of passivity, you know, to accept your position, not to rebel, not to be dissatisfied, to be satisfied with whatever fate gives you. This is just, you know, inhuman. This is, you know, backward superstition. This is, you know, the greedy Brahmins trying to foster on the people some superstition to keep them subjugated. And that's why, you know, ISKCON had a difficult time selling the idea of Varnashram Dharma. We're afraid, you know, our leadership is afraid that it'll be publicly announced that we're from Varnashram, that, oh, we're promoting the caste system, and the most backward superstition. You know, they're afraid that people in the world won't tolerate this idea. But this is the scientific organization of human society. The modern world is nothing but class struggle. In the stable social system, the Brahmins are not greedy. They live very simply, and they're happy to be the teachers and guides of society. And therefore they're trusted. The Kshatriyas are noble, even though they can be egotistical, they can be violent and something to fear. Still, they're honorable, and they protect the citizens, and they obey the Brahminical guidance. So therefore, they're respected and worshipped. And similarly, the Vaishyas, they're also doing their duty. They're productive, even if they're greedy. Still, they're providing all the produce, all the industry that's needed. And the Shudras are doing their work. So everybody's respected. And everybody's feels honorable. Even a Shudra is proud of being a Shudra when the system is stable. But when things are out of control, when the Brahmins become corrupt and greedy, materialistic, when they fail to give the proper guidance to the Kshatriyas, and the Kshatriyas become unruly and weak, and then what happens? Class disorder and class struggle. And that historically we see it, especially in India. Yeah. The Brahmins failed to do their duty and teach properly and guide properly. The Kshatriyas became quarrelsome among one another. India divided up into thousands of petty kingdoms. And there was no problem for foreigners to just march in and take over. beginning with Alexander the Great, 400 BC. There's chaos, there's struggle among the classes when people are not satisfied with their position. And so Bhaktivinoda Thakur explains that this Buddhist religion, going all the way back to 600 BC, was actually, there was political motivation behind the establishment of Buddhism, how it became popular. This is, I think, Sattva Vivek, one book by Bhaktivinoda Thakur, explains. Because the Brahmins were so corrupt, the Kshatriyas didn't want to follow them anymore. So this Buddhist religion came around, and it was sponsored by certain kings. And the kings, these kings took the opportunity to promote Buddhism in order to get rid of the influence of the Brahmins, actually. So that the Kshatriyas could take over and ignore the Brahmins, they supported Buddhism. And Buddhism became prominent in India for 1,000 years. Later, Bhaktivinoda Thakur explains, the Vaishyas tried the same thing by promoting the Jain religion. So you see, even today, there's not many Jains left. A few thousand. But they have a few sannyasis who are very great renunciants. And then the rest of their congregation is all rich businessmen. They don't have anything else. They have, you know, very austere sannyasis and rich Vaishyas. Because the religion was promoted originally by the Vaishyas in order to establish Vaishya power. And what's the situation in the modern world? Is that we don't have any Brahmins left, any real Brahmins, or any real Kshatriyas. People who run the world mostly today are businessmen, money makers, either by legal or illegal means. And they're struggling with the Shudras. The Shudras are trying to take over. So there's a conflict between capitalism and socialism. It's a conflict between the Vaishyas and the Shudras. The Kshatriyas and the Brahmins, and the Brahmins and Kshatriyas, they're already out of the picture. And all that we remain with is a few Vaishyas and a mass of Shudras, each fighting among one another for power. That's the modern situation. That's because of ignoring the principle of chena takena bunjita, being satisfied with your own position and cooperating with all the classes of the social order, working together for spiritual progress. Okay, verse 24. So Vishnu continues.
Navai jatu mishaivasya prajadyapsya madarhanam bhavad videshvatitaram mai sambri bittatmanam.
The Lord continued, my dear Rishi, O leader of living entities, for those who serve me in devotion by worshipping me, especially persons like you, who have given up everything unto me, there is never any question of frustration. Vishnu calls Prajapati Kardama Prajadyaksha, leader of human society. Now usually the word leader, adyaksha means leader, usually we think of a kshatriya, a political leader. But Brahmins are actually in a more real sense, the leaders of society. This is not understood in the modern world. Just like when, at the end of World War II, Hitler was dead already, and they're trying to divide up the world. And Roosevelt and, what's his name in England there? Churchill and Stalin were meeting together, and a few others. They were the you know, the big men, and I think it was Roosevelt made a proposal that they should invite the Pope to join the meeting, spiritual leader. And Stalin said, "Well, look, how many military divisions does the Pope have? Because what kind of leader is he? He's got no army, because the Popes used to have armies."
How is a Brahmin considered a leader? That requires a higher spiritual, a higher understanding of the social order. It's not just political power, it's not just money power. Real power is the power of knowledge. When a Brahmin can speak the truth so honestly that everybody trusts his word, that's the higher power than can be wielded with money or with guns. But we, since we don't have hardly any such Brahmins in the world today, we just don't understand that. We forget about that. And therefore money power and gun power, you know, are ruling the world. But when Brahmins become pure, when they become completely trustworthy, then they can change the world. They can take away that, you know, they can temper this, the unruly power of the Kshatriyas and the Vaishyas. They can keep them under control by the strength of their word. So therefore, Kardama, Vishnu knows what he's talking about. He's calling Kardama the leader of human society. And he says that worshipping me is never wasted, never goes in vain. For surrender to it. Because if someone's trying to play games with God, not honest with God, and God can also play games with him. But for a surrendered devotee, worship is never in vain. You know, if you want to cheat God and to do some business, okay, Krishna can also be a smart businessman. But if you approach him sincerely, not trying to just get something out of him, and you want to give him something, then there's no problem. That will never be frustrated. And he says, especially for surrendered devotees like you, he uses the words "mayi sanglibhita atmana." That means you've dedicated your whole existence to my pleasure. This basically, of course, that's the characteristic of a pure devotee, but also, in a more ordinary sense, is the qualification of a Brahmin. Like we said before, the lower classes, the Vaishyas and the Shudras, they're selfish. Vaishya is out to make a lot of money, maintain his family nicely. Shudra doesn't even care for his family, he's just out to fill his belly, enjoy his senses. Kshatriya and Brahmins, they're selfless. But the Kshatriyas are, you know, ambitious and quarrelsome. The Brahmins, better than anyone else, or more than anyone else, are selfless. And they're actually dedicating their lives to the service of the Supreme. So, Prabhupada explains in the purport, a devotee of the Lord is never frustrated, even if he has material desires. Even the Sakama Bhaktas, the demigods, the sages, they may encounter some difficulty because of their material desires, but ultimately their lives will be successful and they'll become pure devotees. Okay. I've got a few quotations here from the Vedic literatures, especially on the point that Brahmins are worshipful. Here Lord Vishnu is making the point that my devotees are glorious, especially the devotees who dedicate their whole lives to me. So Kardama is a Brahmin. Lord Vishnu is honoring him. And the Brahmins should be honored and respected by everyone. And there are many statements going all the way back to the original Vedas, making that point emphatically, that it's the duty of everybody in human society to have proper respect for the Brahmins, to support them, to listen to them, and to be respectful to them. It's not just some corrupt system that was created by the Brahmins for their own aggrandizement. This is the desire of the Supreme Person. He's expressing it here directly. Okay. Before we get into that, any comments?
Yes, so the Brahmins who are speaking out now are the ones who are behaving the Brahmins.
Yes. Yeah, the qualification is that they're surrendered to Krishna. Yeah. He's not talking about people who claim Brahminical status because of their birth. Yeah. But still, just like in the story of King Nriga, some greedy Brahmin, you know, wouldn't let Nriga go, and you know, I got to have that cow. I won't take another cow, or even 100,000 cows in exchange. So that silly Brahmin, Krishna wanted to respect. He was talking about even such a Brahmin. You know, if someone's a Brahmin, even just externally, still you have to show him respect externally. There's the example of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu when he went to Gaya to do Shraddha for his father. Gaya is famous for having a lot of greedy pandas, you know, Brahmins there, who are always trying to get money from the tourists, from the pilgrims. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu ran into them too. So in Chaitanya Bhagavat, it's explained how he handled them. You know, he didn't get into quarrels with them, he didn't insult them. He pleased them all with sweet words and didn't give them any money. Yes. You know, but he was so polite to them with his sweet words that they were satisfied. But even these greedy Brahmins, the Supreme Lord, you know, insists that we have to show respect. Yes, ma'am?
Yes.
Yes. Well, it's all one world. You know, the so-called aristocracy of Europe originally were kicked out of India, first sons of Yayati and then Parshuram. You know, killed all the Kshatriyas and some of them escaped to Europe and other places. And so the ruling classes of Europe descend from Ashi Kshatriyas that escaped India various times, you know, kicked out of India. So there's a connection there. But there never were any real Brahmins or Kshatriyas in these barbarian places like Europe. You know, they were ruling classes, but they were just, you know, these were all aborigines in the forest, you know, slaughtering one another, and the ones who were the best slaughterers, they became the aristocracy. There was never any real nobility in Europe. The barbarian culture from the start. Now, they just learned how to dress themselves fancy and have a veneer of culture. But they always were barbarians, and we're barbarians by our upbringing, yeah, to be honest. But it's coming originally from the same culture. It's just we're the fringe of Vedic culture, and the same history is this: the history of degradation. But European history, as far back as we can remember it, is degradation from the beginning. It never really was on a high level. We never had any real Brahmins or Kshatriyas. Okay, here's some quotes. Four or five of them. The first one goes about how the Brahmins are worshipable. I think tomorrow I'll be able to hand out the first installment of these quotes, quotations printed out. This is from the Atharva Veda, original Vedic Samhita, the original hymns of the Atharva Veda, the fourth Veda. This is the Veda of mystical magic. Of magic to deal with enemies and obstacles. So this is from the fifth chapter, section 19 of the Atharva Veda. Tadvairastram asravati navam binam ivodakam pramanam yatra Himsanti Tadrastram Hanti Duchana. This is with the intonations up, down, low, high, and middle. The translation is that kingdom where a Brahmin is injured, mistreated, misfortune leaks into that kingdom. Like water leaking into a broken boat. That kingdom is ruined by misfortune if a Brahmin is mistreated. Okay. And then we read one statement from the Shatapatra Brahmana, which is the explanation of the mantras of the Yajurveda, second Veda. I couldn't locate the Sanskrit for this, I'll just read the translation. Somebody who reviles, who insults a Brahmin, the government should give him a fine of 100 coins. He has to pay 100 coins. And if you hit a Brahmin, if you strike a Brahmin, that person who hits a Brahmin, he will not behold the world of the forefathers for as many years as there are grains of dust which the blood of that Brahmin falls on. Now, for every drop of blood of the Brahmin you shed, and for that many years you won't see your forefathers in Pitraloka. Therefore, one should never insult a Brahmin, or certainly don't hit a Brahmin, or draw blood from a Brahmin. That's the greatest, so great is such a sin as the Shatapatra Brahmana. And that's one of the Brahmanas, the Rig Veda Brahmana, called the Aitareya Brahmana, explanation of the Rig Veda, describes the ceremony for coronating a king. That's described in great detail in this and some of the other Brahmanas. Big ritual. Abhishek of the king, installing him on the throne. So the king has to make this vow, according to the Aitareya Brahmana, on the night before his coronation. He announces before all the people. Also, I don't have the Sanskrit for this one either. Oh no, I do. Sanskrit is here. Yam cha ratrim ajayeham, yam cha pretasmi tarubayam, antareneshta purtam me lokam sukritam ayu prajam vinjita yarite druhyeyam. So he makes an announcement in front of everybody. He's speaking to his priest, to the Purohita, the priest who's conducting the Abhishek. Because that's his personal priest. And he has a very important relationship with his priest. The priest is responsible for his spiritual welfare, the king's welfare and his prosperity. So he tells the priest on the night of the coronation, all the sacrifices and welfare work I have ever performed, the good destinations I have earned for the next life, my happiness, my span of life, and all my people, all of this good that I've earned from the night I was born up until the time of my death, you, talking to the priest, you will destroy all of it if I ever treat you as an opponent. If the king ever becomes unfriendly toward his priest, his whole life is ruined. Has to respond. The Kshatriya has to always be respectful to the Brahmins, otherwise he's ruined. One more. This is from Mahabharata, from Bhishma Dev's instructions to Yudhishthira in the Anushasana Parva, chapter 33. Adaivam daivatam kuryu daivatam chapya daivatam yaritcheyu sarajasyad yoneshtasa parabhavet. This is describing the power of the Brahmins. They can make a non-deity into a deity and a deity into a non-deity. That's the power of the Brahmins. That man can become a king who the Brahmins desire him to become. And he who is not, who they don't want to be a king, that man will be defeated. So, any comments on that? Yes,
yes.
just sit. Yes. Okay. Was that heard? Okay.
Yeah, well, basically, you know, can the king be justified in rejecting his guru? It's a serious matter. We heard what, you know, what the king is promising. You know, if I ever become unfriendly to you, then I'm ruined. So has to be strong justification for rejecting the guru, especially for a king to reject his guru. That's not just private business, that's the welfare of the whole country at stake. It's not just his life, it's the life of all the citizens that are going to be affected by this. So only in drastic situations. And it would have to be in consultation. There's not only one Brahmin, there's not only one priest, but a king has a brahminical council. So he has to consult with his council and with the other respected Brahmins before taking such a drastic measure, normally. Because we have the one case of Bali Maharaj. Now, Shukracharya, his priest, same situation, told him, yeah, don't give these three steps to the boy. That's Vishnu. Yeah, he's your enemy. And he refused to obey his guru. And his guru cursed him. Yeah, because of that, rejected him and cursed him. So that's exceptional situation. That should not be imitated by anybody else. Without consulting with other Brahmins to reject your guru. And even if you're not a king, you shouldn't try to find some easy excuse to dump your guru because you feel like you'd like some different one. Yes? Everybody has a guru. Even Krishna and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu accepted gurus. Yeah, maybe, you know, what looks like an exception is Shukadeva Goswami. He didn't take initiation from anybody. But again, that shouldn't be imitated. But he didn't take initiation. He never was initiated. But he took instruction from Vyasadeva. He accepted Vyasadeva as Shiksha Guru. So otherwise, anybody who's a, you know, Aryan, who's making progress in spiritual life, has to have a guru, not just Chaitya Guru. It has to be combined effort of the inside and outside gurus. Guru Krishna Prasadi Parivakti Vatavij. By the combined mercy of the outside guru and the Chaitya Guru on the inside, one gets the seed of devotion awakened in his heart. Without that, you can't get proper guidance. You have to have a guru. No matter who you are. Even if you're God, you know, you set the example by accepting a guru. Okay. Who was it? Indra ran off, was, you know, got in trouble kidnapping somebody's wife, and he was, you know, he got a sinful curse and got a sinful reaction. He had to leave heaven and he was hiding in the lotus pond, and then there was, you know, and the demigods were without a king, so they looked down on the earth and they saw, here's what's his name, Nahusha, best available Kshatriya on the earth, and they installed him as Indra. So actually it was, you know, the Brihaspati, the Brahmin priest of the demigods, who advised them to take this Nahusha, this earthling, and turn him into the king of heaven. So by the advice and empowerment of the priest of the demigods, this ordinary king became a demigod. Then he showed his earthly failings, and he tried to enjoy Indra's wife, and then he got in trouble. He was kicked out. So the Brahmin, the same Brahmins, can make someone, an ordinary person, into a deity and make him back into an ordinary person again. Yes?
Was there an exception to that?
Did you mention an exception? Shukadeva. Shukadeva, you know, Anipeta. He never took initiation. He's a speaker of the Bhagavatam, but he never had initiation. Uninitiated bhakta. Bhakta Shukadeva. But he heard the Bhagavatam. He listened. He took shiksha from Vyasadeva. He's the exception. Otherwise, every bona fide Vaishnava has taken it. It's a thing you do. You take initiation. Even if it's a formality, like the formality that everybody follows. Even if you have a much more intense relationship with your shiksha guru, still you always have a shiksha diksha guru. You always take initiation. You always give respect to your diksha guru. Even if you get most of your instruction from somebody else. Or even if you're God and you don't need any instruction. Okay. That's book 25. Prajapati Sutat Sangran Manur Vikyat Mangalaha Brahmavartam Yodi Vatsan Shasti Saptarnava Mahim. So Vishnu is not simply trying to pacify Kardama and tell him some philosophy just to keep him quiet, but he's going to get down to business here and show how he's actually arranging for the fulfillment of Kardama's desires. So he says, Lord Vishnu says, the emperor, Svayambhuva Manu, the son of Lord Brahma, who is well known for his righteous acts, has his seat in Brahmavarta and rules over the earth with its seven oceans. So now Vishnu introduces Svayambhuva Manu. Why? What business does a rishi have to do with the king? But this is the answer to Kardama's his ambition. So Prajapati Sutta, he's the son of the original Prajapati, Brahma, and he's emperor of the whole earth. And he's very famous, not for conquering or for being a giver of charity, but for his auspicious personality, his saintly personality. Vikyata Mangala. Prabhupada explains, in the word-for-word synonyms, Prabhupada translates Mangala as righteous acts, or in the translation it says righteous acts. Then in the purport, he explains more thoroughly. His mangala, or the auspiciousness of Svayambhuva Manu, is the opulences of his religious performances, his ruling power, his cleanliness, and his other good qualities. So these are the good qualities of a kshatriya. Here's our prototype kshatriya. He's the first ruler of human society. Before that, there were only demigods. He's the first leader of human society. All the human beings are the descendants of Manu, Manuja. Manuja means human being, born from Manu. So Manu is the first human being. He's the first king of all humans. He's the first human kshatriya. So he displays the perfect qualities of a kshatriya. And they're not the same as the perfect qualities of a Brahmin. We read from the Shataphatra Brahmana yesterday. Brahmin, by his austerities, his intelligence becomes pure, and he develops four good qualities. He takes a good birth. He behaves very properly. He has a spotless reputation. He has influence because of his honesty. And he's able to elevate the population by his instructions. Now, kshatriya has four good qualities mentioned here by Prabhupada in the purport, but they're different. They also benefit society, but in a different way. He performs religious sacrifices, opulent sacrifices. By performance of big sacrifices, the whole population is benefited. If you perform a sacrifice in your house, that'll benefit your family. But if you perform a big sacrifice, that'll benefit everybody. The king is very expert. He has the opulence to perform big sacrifices. And he can, if he's righteous, he can perform them nicely. He has ruling power. That's not a quality of a Brahmin. Brahmins don't try to control anybody. But the kshatriya's business is to control. And that's his glory, is that he can control other people. But righteously. He's clean. Not just he takes a shower, but he's clean in his behavior. and his thought and his words. And he has other good qualities. So anyway, that's how Swayambhuvamanu is auspicious. It's not it's auspicious in a different way than Karjuna. He celebrated, where does that word come? Celebrated, famous, popular. The king should not be anonymous. You know, you shouldn't keep a low key. A king has to be very prominent and have charisma and be loved by the people to be effective. Whereas, on the other hand, Brahmins are more anonymous. They're not out for reputation. Well, they want to have influence. They want to help society and have their instructions heard. But they're not out for their own reputation, for, you know, for being worshipped on their own. Brahmins are more anonymous. That's why in the Bhagavatam is stories about Vishnu, about the Supreme Person, Bhagavan, and about the Bhagavats. Bhagavatam is a book about Bhagavan and Bhagavats, the Lord and his devotees. You would think that the Brahmins should be the best devotees. And they are. I mean, the Brahmins are pure. Kshatriyas are more passionate. Then why is the Bhagavatam filled with stories about kings? You know, count how many of these, a couple of thousand, 3,000 kings described in the Bhagavatam, how many Brahmins? A few hundred. And then you don't hear much about the Brahmins. Brahmins are more anonymous, and also, you know, to us in the modern world, the exploits of kings are more interesting to hear about. You know, he did this and he did that, so many amazing things. Got into trouble this way and that way. And the Brahmins, they just sit and meditate, go back to God. There's not much interesting to describe. Yeah. So Brahminical life is more anonymous, more simple, and the life of a king is more glorious and makes more interesting history. Okay. One last verse, and then I want to propose a topic for discussion. Maybe tomorrow we can have a debate on this. Verse 26. There's no purport to 26, but I'll read the verse.
Sacheha vipra rajarshir mahishya shatarupaya ayasyati jadrikshustvam parashvo dharmakovidaha.
So Lord Vishnu tells him, quite frankly, the day after tomorrow, O Brahman, that celebrated emperor who is expert in religious activities will come here with his queen, Shatarupa, wishing to see you. Okay. So Lord Vishnu says that Manu is a Rajarshi, and he's very expert in religious principles. Kshatriyas also know Dharma. They also are trained up in the Vedas to understand the principles of religion, but in their own way. You know, Kshatriya gets a Vedic education, but not in the same to the same extent as a Brahmin. Yeah. He learns especially the duties of a king and the principles of religion in relationship to human society. Whereas a Brahmin goes more into depth into the essence of religion. And a Brahmin, a Kshatriya, he may learn so many, he may get so much of a Vedic education, he may be able to chant mantras, even perform sacrifices, a Kshatriya. But he can't be independent from the Brahmins. He always has to rely on their guidance. To be a Kshatriya means to be involved with the motive passion, to sometimes have a hothead, and therefore you have to be guided. If you're a hothead Kshatriya, you have to be guided and tempered by the cool-headed Brahmins who are not involved in politics. It's always like that. The Kshatriyas depend on the guidance, on the support of the Brahmins to keep them under control. A Kshatriya without guidance will be misdirected and unruly. Okay, so that's the basic point. We'll discuss more about that later. Here I'd like to open up a discussion. How is this relevant to the current situation of Islam. Okay. Here's my argument.
Okay.
So I'm arguing, you know, from one point that there's nothing wrong. You know, because aren't the leaders of our society, they're all following Prabhupada. They're very sincere devotees. They're the most sincere devotees among us. They've dedicated their lives to Prabhupada. Why should we propose, you know, someone else is proposing, I'm arguing against it here, that we have to have a separate ecumenical function in this time. This is being discussed now by the GBC. You know, they're talking about right now about proposals to set up a special ecumenical council for the GBC. So I'm arguing, why is that necessary? What I'm proposing is we discuss this tomorrow. Now think about it. We'll start a debate tomorrow. And you choose what side you'd like to argue. Yeah. The question then is, do we actually need in ISKCON to establish a separate ecumenical voice, like a separate community of Brahmins to give advice? Do we really need that, because aren't we taking advice from Prabhupada? Yeah. So the question is this Vedic system relevant to ISKCON or not? And you can take your side and argue and give reasons. You have an opinion, but then also back it up. Okay, and we'll ask everybody tomorrow what side you want to argue from. And we'll split the class, either sit on this side or that side. Okay. Any questions?
It's more like the first one, first of all, praying, and then the rule of turning fields, turning time.
Yes. Yes. That's the day of the Varaha Kalpa. Yes. Which one is Varaha Kalpa? We're in the Shweta Varaha Kalpa now, actually. And as far as I understand, I'm sorry? I think that's the current day of Brahma, the one we're living in now. Because as far as I understand, this narration of the second half of the third canto, or the whole third canto, is occurring in the current day of Brahma. Whereas what was described in the first two cantos was the very first day of Brahma. No, way back. Yeah, in the beginning of his life. And now Brahma is middle-aged. He's 50 years old now. And we're in his 50th year at about 10:30 in the morning on a certain day, you know, and it's called the Shweta Varaha Kalpa. It's the day of Brahma in which Lord Varaha appears in his white form. Sometimes Varaha appears in different days of Brahma, but he has different colors. So white Varaha appears in this day, and it's called the Shweta Varaha Kalpa. Yeah. You can be a Brahminically inclined Kshatriya or administrative Brahmana. You have many of both. Look at Yudhishthira. He's a Kshatriya, but he's practically a Brahmana. Doesn't like to fight, he doesn't want to rule, he'd like to sit and talk to Brahmins and perform sacrifices. If he had his choice, he'd be a Brahmin, but he's a Kshatriya. So his passion is very much mixed up with goodness. And then you've got Brahmins who are very much involved in politics. You know, they're basic political nature, but there's a lot of passion there. So you have many cases of there's no fifth Varna there, but there's borderline Brahmins and Kshatriyas are mixed. It's useful. You know, a government needs Brahmins, Brahminical advisors. If a government can engage Brahmins in helping administer, that's very useful. Brahmins make good administrators. But you also need ideal Brahmins. You can't have all the Brahmins mixed up in passion. So who's going to be the original teachers? You need some Brahmins to stay in the ashrams, in the forest, and stay aloof from politics. You need some pure Brahmins. Otherwise, human society is without a head. If all the Brahmins get involved in the government service, then the world goes to hell. Okay, so we can stop here. Think a bit about what you want to, what position you want to take, and we'll discuss tomorrow about this question.